Welcome to this weekly audio digest edition of the Herald Scotland, from Friday the 10th to Thursday the 16th of May 2019. Read by volunteers at Kieran Review, Frank Speaking to the Blind, at our studios in Fisher-Price Media Centre. The headlines in part 1.
Lion Kent hints at Rangers Day.
Agenda. Cybersecurity should be part of our culture.
Letters. Do not elect those who do not want to serve.
Extremist Brexit Party is not the voice of Leave voters.
Ministers reject claims a Scottish smacking ban will lead to a rise in police investigations of parents.
Neil Lennon, proposed Champions League revamp makes reaching group stages vital for Celtic next season.
Tiger Woods' latest major quest gives US PGA Championship huge boost.
Letters. Close Glasgow Airport, not Prestwick.
The Herald, 10th of May 2019, Lion Kent hints at Rangers Day. The Ringer, immortalised in a Joy Division song, Always a Good Thing, will return to Liverpool, but with little hope of him getting a game with his parent club. The 22-year-old is certain to go out on loan. And as his year at Ibrox has gone so well, Kent picked up PFA Scotland's Young Player of the Year on Sunday. Another season with Rangers is an option. Kent said, "It's something I have a really good think about in the summer. But first of all, I want us to finish the league campaign as strongly as possible. And that's all I'm thinking about right now. I'll have plenty of time in the summer to think about the other stuff and discuss it with my representatives. Possibly because I came up here to win trophies, and that department we failed in the season. So it'll be nice to come back and win silverware. But I don't have anything more to say on that at the moment. The size of the club brings us out the best in me. I didn't realise how huge it was until I came here. Once I saw it for the first time and realised what football meant to these fans, what winning meant to them, it helped the mental side of my game. That's what the manager wants. He wants winners. Rangers won't win anything, but Kent has and was thrilled to be voted best player under 23 by his peers. He admitted this wasn't in my thoughts when I came here. After a disappointing year, I just wanted to enjoy my football again and receive this award caps a fine season for me on a personal level. Working with two coaches who played at the highest level, you can always take little things from them which you can add to your own game. Since day one, the team has really welcomed me and I've settled really well, which hasn't always been the case in the past. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself here and it's brought out the best in me. The teams in the bottom half of the league are the ones we probably struggled most against this season, coming up against a low block and different game plans. However, I feel as though I come alive against the bigger teams. I've stepped up to the plate and created chances of those occasions. Ask anyone about Kent and they will say the same thing, that he's a talented boy but not consistent. After a slow start, the Ringer has been one of Steven Gerrard's best players, thanks to him becoming a better professional. Kent revealed, "My dedication off the field has also played a part. I'm always trying to better myself and I do extra work in a gym towards that end. There's a lot more to come from me. These days, unless you're scoring a lot of goals, you don't always get the credit you deserve and your performance on the pitch aren't always represented in your status, and that's all people look at now." Kent wants Rangers here in the past Old Firm games. If this is his final days as a Ranger, he fancies saying goodbye in the best possible way. He said it would be nice to sign off with another goal against Celtic, to be honest. "I'd like to have scored a few more goals than I have done this season. Even though I've already scored more than any other season, I'll keep trying to improve that side of my game. Every game we've played this season we've tried to be dominant, but it's particularly important for us to take the 3 points this weekend because it'll show the intent that Rangers have for next season."
The Herald Scotland. Opinion. Recorded on the 10th of May 2019. Agenda. Cybersecurity should be part of our culture. From the Agenda column by Ross Foley, Cybersecurity Director, PwC Scotland. Cybersecurity has become one of the major societal challenges of the internet age. What was once the domain of IT and security professionals has become a board-level business issue, a challenge which each of us face on a daily basis. The paradigm shift we have experienced in terms of the threat must be mirrored in the scale of our response. We must give all people the skills to protect themselves and ultimately ensure the cyber resilience of UK PLC. I was infused by the message of collaboration and teamwork that came across loud and clear from key figures from both the public and private sectors at the recent Cyber UK event in Glasgow. In his opening address to delegates, Kieran Martin, CEO of NCSC, the government agency responsible for cybersecurity, described the event as the coming together of the team tasked with defending the UK in cyberspace. Working as a team, there are three equally important challenges we must address in order if we are to achieve the Scottish Government's aim of becoming a world leader in cyber resilience, and create an environment where cybersecurity simply becomes embedded in our culture, both at home and in the workplace. 1. Provide all citizens with a baseline knowledge of the tools and techniques they can use to protect themselves in cyberspace. 2. Create a sustainable and broad pipeline of cybersecurity talent. 3. Foster a culture of collaboration between government, our security services and the private sector. An effective first step is to recognise that cybersecurity is now simply a fundamental life skill for children of the internet age, one which goes hand in hand with the road and personal safety lessons that we all remember from our own school days. For businesses, cybersecurity must become as fundamental as health and safety has now become, and at a public sector level, it must sit among others deemed critical to a functioning society, such as healthcare or the emergency services. It's also important to recognise that the next generation of cyber defenders are not just security managers or coders, but everyone from the future CEOs to any worker who views, holds or processes information. Technology, data and electronic communications are so intrinsically linked with our lives that cybersecurity begins and ends with every employee of an organisation or every citizen of a state. Ultimately, the more we build security into the culture of our citizens, the more cyber resilient our organisations will be. The work of organisations such as Skill Development Scotland are fundamental to addressing these challenges, driving a sustainable pipeline of cybersecurity professionals. However, while we have a steady stream of technical graduates from highly respected cybersecurity degree programmes at both Abertay and Napier universities, it is imperative that we remember that security requires a broad range of technical and non-technical disciplines. The cybersecurity industry has also long been criticised for its lack of diversity, with NCSC commenting in 2017 that we needed a much more diverse workforce in order to combat ever more sophisticated cyber threats. Driving greater diversity of gender, ethnicity, background and thought are all vital aspects of creating a cyber resilient workforce. While the challenge may seem daunting, it is clear that the appetite to drive change is real. All cybersecurity professionals hold a duty to facilitate this agenda, so I look forward to further opportunities for our community to come together and support the cross-sector conversation and collaboration required to build the foundations of our future cyber resilience. From the Agenda column by Ross Foley, Cybersecurity Director, PwC Scotland.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know somebody who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio, where our daily podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF, you need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk, and remember, when setting up the player, ask for the Q&A review channels. Now, back to the main programme.
The Herald. Opinion. Recorded on the 13th of May, 2019. Letters. Do not elect those who do not want to serve. Like many others, I have recently received my postal ballot paper for the forthcoming EU election. Looking over the ballot paper, I was amazed but not surprised to see that the two major parties who are still currently conspiring to agree a deal which will take us out of the EU have the brass neck to field candidates. Yes, I know there are constitutional reasons why they must do so. But where do they find individuals within their ranks prepared to take their seats within an organisation they are committed to leave? Whilst in doing so, of course, accepting the handsome salary which goes with it. If this isn't cynicism or hypocrisy, what is? To add to the woes, neither party seems inclined to permit the electorate the opportunity of expressing a view on any eventual Brexit deal, 3 years post-referendum, despite there being so much more accurate information now available regarding the real pros and cons of departure. Conservatives, definitely not Labour, maybe yes, perhaps. For both these reasons, at least for this election, one which will not materially affect the internal politics of Brexit, I feel I can only vote for candidates who are committed to membership of the EU and who can honestly and constructively represent us therein. If others are persuaded to do so likewise, who knows? It might serve notice again on all the parties that we are neither amused nor supportive of their efforts and self-serving to date. Yours sincerely, Jane Napier. Alva. Nothing illustrates more clearly what is wrong with the party list system of proportional representation than the Brexit Party Election Communication Scotland. Mailed presumably to all Scottish voters, photographs and attributed quotes are given for seven people, four described as our candidates, and the other three described as new Brexit Party candidates. So I guess it would be reasonable for voters to assume that in placing their X against the Brexit Party, they are voting for any number of up to six of these candidates to be elected. If you have a postal vote and therefore can examine a ballot paper, it becomes more interesting because none of these seven names appear on it. So who are these seven candidates? In fact, they are all standing in English regions except for Joel Chilica, who doesn't appear to be standing anywhere in the UK. Of course, you might only see who you are voting for when you get your ballot paper in the polling station and discover a new set of names. We are therefore expected to vote for the Brexit Party without having the faintest idea who the candidates are or why we should vote to elect them. If the Brexit Party gets enough votes in Scotland to get a seat, Mr Farage gets to decide who represents us, and some of us remember with extreme regret who he picked as the Scottish UKIP representative in 2014. That's the party list system for you. You need to ask more than PR. It has to be single, transferable vote. Thomas G.F. Gray, Lindsay. Peter Russell's letter, May the 10th, reminded me of something published here some weeks ago, arguing the same point, that if Scotland uses sterling in the informal way suggested by the Growth Commission, it can be contented that with no currency of our own, we could not commit to joining the euro when conditions allow and if we choose to do so, as we could not participate in ERM2, and thus might not, just as Mr Russell asserts, be able to join the EU at all. Imagine my surprise to discover the letter's author was me, April the 18th. However, in contrast to Mr Russell's prognosis of doom and gloom and disaster, I continued, but Scotland could still secure single market access by joining ETFA and committing to the EEA, and likewise frictionless trade by joining the EU's customs union. And thus that if even if we are not EU members, we can still achieve many of Scotland's European ambitions. Furthermore, this would be in no way inconsistent with the statements of the First Minister since June 2016, and in regard to the EU at least, render obsolete questions about currency, such as Mr Russell's. His letter, therefore, is a trademark better together argument that the EU will not let us join, yet many European ambitions could be achieved without joining. However, my letter, of which he is critical of, was a reply to Ian Lankin, who had argued that Scotland would have to use the euro letters May 8, but as I pointed out, the timetable to this end would be for the Scottish electorate. Thus, both Messrs Russell and Lankin arguments managed to be wrong, even though based on conflicting suppositions about our membership or not of the EU. This damned if they do and damned if they don't approach is one we became familiar with in 2014. A particularly notable example then was that all the banks would leave if we voted yes, but that they would ruin us in the event of another banking crash, which could only happen if they had remained in Scotland. As with Mr. Russell and Mr. Lankin's propositions, both cannot be true at the same time, not even in Scotland. Most remarkably though, having spent the preceding part of his letter assuring us that Scotland could not join the EU because we have no currency of our own, Mr Russell cannot resist the temptation of forecasting Greek-style austerity within the euro for Scotland once we had implemented our own currency. But in so doing, he ignores the point that I made earlier to Ian Lankin, that by joining the EU we might have to commit to adopting the euro, but the timetable and indeed deciding whether to do so or not would be matters for the Scottish electorate. Alistair Galloway, Dumbarton. George Dale and Sam Craig, letters May 10, ask, have the parties given up on British voters in the run-up to the EU elections, and who would trust the leader of the Brexit Party? Perhaps we should look at those questions from a wholly Scottish perspective. At no time has the Scottish Government given up on trying to represent the Scottish people in Europe or at the Brexit negotiation table. It has simply been excluded. As to the second question, the Scottish people in 2016 didn't trust Nigel Farage under the UKIP banner, as Scotland voted to remain. Katrina C. Clark, Falkirk. Can I ask Carol Ford, Letters May 9, exactly where Scotland is looking ridiculous, or exactly where it's diminished, given that news from and about Scotland is largely confined to, well, Scotland? Unionists can't help themselves from putting down the Scottish Government in areas such as railways, education, health, police and so on, when even they must know that most parts of England have a very much worse record. Ian Bailey, Alexandria.
Article from Herald Scotland, 14th of May 2019. Opinion. Letters. Extremist Brexit Party is not the voice of Leave voters. I am disappointed that the Electoral Commission has allowed the Brexit Party to be so named because its sole aim is to leave the EU with no deal. For those who do not follow politics closely, this name and the justification for the party's existence mislead the electorate on two counts. One, no deal was overwhelmingly defeated in Parliament. There is no chance of it being supported by a majority of parliamentarians in the future. Two, the Leave referendum manifesto committed the UK to leaving the EU with a negotiated settlement. This has been achieved but is rejected by this party. I am a Brexiter. I firmly believe that the proposed further integration of 27 countries with different economies, cultures and languages is unsustainable. Nevertheless, our financial prosperity depends on us maintaining a friendly and productive relationship with our neighbours. It annoys me when those with extreme views presume to speak for me and the many like me. Iris Clyde, Kirkwall. Andrew Marr's massacre of Nigel Farage's farrago of free market fantasies highlighted the weaknesses of Mr. Farage's stance and pinpointed the default position of people of his ilk. Brexit Party overtakes Tories in poll of Westminster voting intentions. The Herald, May the 13th. Whenever your points of principle are attacked, resort to bluster or smears against the personality of the interrogator. How farcical of Mr. Farage to question Marr's intelligence in the hope of diverting the interviewer from examining the principles which drive men of that kind. Mr. Farage's popularity is based upon his cosy man-of-the-people persona, brimming with his legendary bonhomie which beguiles so many, and this from a man whose background was far from unprivileged. Marr's steadfast attempts at a polite forensic examination of Mr. Farage's views were constantly punctuated by the blustering interjections of his interviewee, desperate to have the interview concentrate on his own chosen territory. The focus by Marr was ad rem when, vainly, Mr. Farage tried to needle Marr with his ad hominem, diversion. Sadly, not enough people would have seen this interview, which revealed that Mr. Farage is no more than a man puffed up by his own self-importance, bolstered by his peculiar brand of bombast, behind which there is just a man of straw. Dennis Bruce, Bishop Briggs. Through the door has arrived an election communication from the Brexit Party. The only connection with Scotland seems to be the word Scotland printed on the front. Scotland was split down the middle in the independence referendum, voting 55-45, a result likely to be replicated should Nicola Sturgeon be foolish enough to try again. But in many ways, Scotland is not divided. Scotland supports having its own parliament. Scotland wants to stay in the EU. What Scotland does not like is interlopers who try to take advantage. The latest in the long line of people who think Scots are daft and can be taken for a ride is the Brexit Party. Its election document shows three candidates, one from London, one from Lowestoft, the other from Sussex. Two other candidates are a property developer and a CEO of a property company. The Brexit Party is masquerading as a party for the common man, whereas it is nothing of the sort. It is a right-wing party stuffed full of disaffected Tories. The last time Nigel Farage came to Edinburgh, he had to be rescued by the police. Time to send this banker packing back to the City of London without the votes he needs to keep on the gravy train. Phil Tate, Edinburgh. Andrew Marr was quite right to question Nigel Farage about the policies a Farage-led or influenced governor would adopt, and to quote previous comments on issues such as immigration, NHS and smaller government. After all, he claimed the EU election would herald the end of two-party government, so these questions are hardly irrelevant. Sadly, Maher's robust and persistent line only seems to be reserved for certain individuals or parties, and not the likes of Nicola Sturgeon, who invariably gets off with an approach only a few notches above asking what her favourite colour is. What's good for the gander is good for the goose. Miss Sturgeon has done and threatens a lot more damage to Scotland than Mr Farage has or ever will. Alan Sutherland, Stonehaven. Some correspondents, letters, May the 11th, decry Holyrood as not being representative of the electorate and that it fails to achieve consensus. Yet the composition of our Parliament is much more reflective of the votes cast than Westminster is. The SNP, I am not a member, is the most popular Scottish party with the public. It is a centrist, social democratic party, yet cannot find a partner for a coalition among the others. It is surely ironic that the big two are now both separatist when it comes to one union, yet refuse to form any partnership with the SNP because of its separatism towards another union. The Scottish Lib Dems, I honestly have no idea what role they wish to play in Scotland, other than costing the public a fortune in freedom of information requests. But we should have concerns over the distancing of the elected from the electorate. It is as a result of the Brexit debacle, and that is being reflected in the fracturing of decades-old voting habits in England, Scotland having already gone through a similar process. The main UK parties appear to be shedding much of their core vote, and with the first-past-the-post electoral system, this should raise concerns about the ability of any party having a strong and stable government in the future. In Scotland, we may have a minority government, but it is broadly coherent, enjoys reasonable popularity, and governs with its devolved responsibilities, achieving generally better outcomes than elsewhere in the UK. G.R. Weir, Ochiltree. Welcome to Scotland, the country that is fast becoming the most taxed part of the UK. We're getting a parking tax for parking at your place of work. We're getting a 20 pence tax on plastic bottles and cans, which means your multipacks is going to cost much more. We have minimum pricing of alcohol. And to finish off, we have a 21p basic rate tax band, while the UK is 20. What's next to be taxed? Is it really the best way to grow the economy and encourage people to settle in Scotland? Jim Robertson, Glasgow G53.
Cue and Review Print Speaking to the Blind are a charity based in Bishop Briggs. We're currently looking to recruit volunteer access to audio ambassadors in East and Bartonshire to place leaflets and business cards at businesses, shops and amenities in the area, and to show the public how to listen to daily and weekly online articles from the Herald Scotland, Evening Times, The National and Inside Soap magazine for free. If you would like to volunteer and become an access to audio ambassador, please contact Michael Rankin on 0141 772 3976 or email aaatl@qandreview.com. That's aaatl@qandreview.com. In addition, we are also recruiting for volunteer readers and technicians. If you're interested in reading or technically supporting a recording team, please contact us on 0141 772 3976 or email information@qandreview.com. Details of all of our volunteering opportunities are available on our website at qandreview.com. Thank you. Now, back to the main programme.
Ministers reject claims a Scottish smacking ban will lead to a rise in police investigations of parents. An article by Martin Williams, senior news reporter, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 14th of May, 2019. Ministers have rejected concerns over a huge rise in cases against parents if a ban on smacking is brought in. Critics have said research from Wales shows that if the defence of reasonable chastisement is removed, there could be an estimated 1,370 smacking allegations recorded in the first 5 years. The Be Reasonable group said that if the figures produced by the police liaison unit for the Welsh Government are extrapolated to take account of Scotland's higher population, that would lead to an estimated 2,370 investigations into smacking allegations against Scottish parents in the first 5 years of a new law. Spokesman Simon Calvert said, "That's a massive figure. MSPs are living in cloud cuckoo land if they still think parents will not be criminalised by a ban," he said. "Supporters of the ban must stop misleading the public about the real-world consequences of what they propose." MSPs have been taking evidence on the Children Equal Protection from Assault Scotland Bill, which would remove the defence of justifiable assault in Scots law, which allows parents to use physical punishment on children. A public consultation on the issue in 2017 received more than 650 responses, with about 75% being in favour of the ban. The Scottish Government, however, has dismissed fears of a rise in investigations. A Scottish Government spokesman said, "This bill will give children the same legal protections as adults, something backed by an overwhelming majority of public opinion, and will seek to remove the defence of reasonable chastisement that currently exists in law. Based on experience from New Zealand, we do not expect a large number of prosecutions. We have set up an implementation group which will consider what actions need to be taken if the bill becomes law. We will continue to offer funding for a range of family support services and resources to help parents and carers." A University of Stirling academic has described the warnings as alarmist. Professor Jane Callaghan, Director of Child Wellbeing and Protection, who has already given evidence to the Scottish Parliament's Equalities and Human Rights Committee, said, "It is difficult to critique either the PLU figures or Be Reasonable's manipulation of the data, as no methodological information is provided. There's nothing terribly rigorous or convincing about their attempts to provoke a bit of panic, though. I also don't think their work really undermines the main rationale of the proposed amendment. Children are one of the few kinds of human to whom we seem to feel it is acceptable to deny full personhood. Smacking communicates to children that they are lesser beings worthy of violence, and a state that allows such chastisement effectively ratifies children's positioning as less worthy of basic human rights and protections. The bottom line is that smacking is ineffective, and in opposition to any notion of children as human beings with human rights. We know it has no positive effects and that it raises the risk of negative outcomes for children. It should not be a defensible element of parenting practice. Smacking, or using reasonable force to discipline a child, was outlawed in New Zealand since 2007 and prompted similar concerns as in Scotland, with many claiming that it would criminalise good parents. A 2009 review in New Zealand found that agencies were not hunting down smackers and that the fabric of family life was not deteriorating because parents had become too frightened to discipline their kids. But Bob McCoskrey, National Director of Family First New Zealand, a conservative Christian lobby group, has been fighting the ban since it came into force more than a decade ago and said last year that he wanted Scotland to take heed. He said in September that since the introduction of the law, Family First had not found a single social indicator relating to the welfare of children which showed any improvement. He claims this is evidence for the ban's failure and quoted police statistics from 2016, which show significant increases in the reporting of child physical and sexual abuse in New Zealand since 2007. A 2016 survey also found that two-thirds of parents in New Zealand say they would be willing to flout the law, while a 2011 study suggested a third of parents had been threatened by their children with being reported to the police if they were smacked. Police Scotland has previously warned MSPs that a smacking ban could result in increased costs to the force as officers spent more time investigating allegations against parents. The police has also raised concerns that the ban proposed by Highlands and Islands MSP John Finney, with Scottish Government backing, could interfere with family life. The force's concerns were contained in a document submitted to Holyrood's Equality and Human Rights Committee, which is examining the proposed legislation. The document said, Police Scotland envisages that the repeal of the defence provided by Section 51 of the Criminal Justice Scotland Act 2003 will result in an increase in reporting. This will have potential cost, resource implications for Police Scotland and partner agencies. It adds, on occasions it may be assessed that the harm is not, nor is likely to be significant, following a report of what is commonly referred to as chastisement. Notwithstanding, there would be a duty on the police to investigate any assault on a child and, if a sufficiency of evidence exists, report the circumstances to Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service. Under the Criminal Justice Scotland Act 2003, Scottish law currently prohibits parents from shaking their child, striking their head and from using an implement during punishment. But defences of a reasonable chastisement or justifiable assault can be used in court by parents who physically punish their children. Courts determine whether the punishment is reasonable or justifiable based on factors such as nature of the punishment inflicted, the circumstances, the physical and mental effect on the child and the child's age. The new Children Equal Protection from Assault Scotland Bill will prohibit the physical punishment of children by parents and others caring for or in charge of children. It will give children equal protection from assault by abolishing the existing defences that parents can use to justify the use of physical force to discipline a child. Those backing the bill say a wider aim of it is to redefine what is acceptable in terms of how to punish children and encourage other methods of parenting.
The Herald Scotland. Sport, recorded on the 15th of May, 2019. Neil Lennon, proposed Champions League revamp makes reaching group stages vital for Celtic next season. By chief football writer Matthew Lindsay. Neil Lennon last night admitted the proposed Champions League revamp has increased the importance of Celtic qualifying for the group stages of Europe's elite club competition in the coming seasons. However, Lennon has backed Peter Lawle, the Parkhead Chief Executive and European Clubs Association ECA Executive Board Member, to fight for the best possible deal for the Glasgow club and their Scottish counterparts at talks later this month. UEFA have suggested changing the structure of the tournament to four groups of eight from the start of the 2024-25 season, following talks with the ECA, a body that represents more than 200 clubs across the continent. The plan would, if given the go-ahead, see the top 24 teams in the Champions League get in automatically, while four sides from a second-tier league would be promoted and another four clubs would qualify. If passed, it will mean the larger clubs from the English, French, German, Italian and Spanish leagues will substantially increase their revenue from the competition, while their rivals from smaller footballing nations like the Netherlands, Portugal and Scotland will find it harder to get in. The plans, which are being driven by Juventus chairman Andrea Agnelli, have been met with stiff opposition from the Premier League in England and League One in France, as they would mean increasing the number of group games from 6 to 14. Lennon, who is hoping to be kept on as manager after the William Hill Scottish Cup final against Hearts on Saturday, stressed that making it through the group stages will be even more vital for Celtic in the future, if the changes are accepted. We've got to prepare for that, try to progress and be ready for that when it comes, he said. I think it's really important to try to get into that upper echelon and stay there. Asked if he was confident that Law would get the best deal for Celtic, Lennon said 100% yes. It's important for Scottish clubs. Even if you think about Eastern European clubs, sometimes they don't get a fair crack of the whip, even the Dutch ones. Lennon, who led Celtic to the knockout rounds of the Champions League for only the third time in their history back in 2012 after beating Barcelona at Parkhead in the group stages, feels the performance of Ajax this season shows that clubs from smaller countries can still challenge. He also predicted that Amsterdam clubs' progress to the last four will give Celtic belief when they enter the Champions League qualifying rounds at the start of the 2019-20 campaign. "They've been great," he said. "They have been a breath of fresh air. They play wonderful football. To go to Real Madrid and win was amazing. Then they beat Juventus away. I haven't seen an Italian team get done like that at home in a European game for a long, long time." The way Ajax played against Juventus, it could have been 4 or 5. They were absolutely outstanding. And that's the Italian champions, so it's got to give a lot of inspiration to a lot of clubs, including ourselves. Ajax have had a stellar season. They are the first team to make the semi-finals from the qualifying rounds. We have 4 qualifiers. It's a big ask. You get tough draws. It's important we keep trying to progress in the right way for that format if it does come in. Lennon admitted this season's Champions League knockout rounds, which saw both Liverpool and Spurs stage astonishing comebacks against Barcelona and Ajax to reach the final in Madrid next month, had increased his desire to get Celtic back into the group stages if he is kept on as manager. "Of course it does," he said. "It should whet the players' appetite as well." The Northern Irishman also believes the contribution that Andy Robertson and Virgil van Dijk of Liverpool and Victor Wanyama of Spurs made as the Anfield and the new White Hart Lane clubs made it through to the final in Madrid reflects well on the game in this country. Robertson previously played for Queen's Park and Dundee United, while van Dijk and Wanyama both represented Celtic. "You've got 3 players, Wanyama, van Dijk and Robertson, who 5 years ago were playing their trade in Scotland, now playing in the Champions League final," said Lennon. By chief football writer Matthew Lindsay.
Remember, this Weekly Digest programme is just a selection of what we produce. You can access more daily content online for free at qnreview.com/freepodcasts. For free daily podcasts of the Herald Scotland and Evening Times, and weekly digests of The National and Inside Soap magazine. Alternatively, you can access all of these services via a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio player. Now, back to the main programme.
The Glasgow Herald from 16th of May 2019. Sport. Tiger Woods' latest major quest gives US PGA Championship huge boost. When it was confirmed in 2017 that US PGA Championship would move from its traditional August date to May from 2019, Tiger Woods was 4 months removed from spinal fusion surgery and just 3 from being arrested on suspicion of driving under the influence. So it's no wonder the tournament has been described as hitting the lottery as it welcomes newly crowned Masters champion Woods and the rest of the field to Bethpage State Park for the first US PGA to be staged in May since 1949. "We were very excited about the May change even before Tiger set off his fireworks in Georgia," Seth Woch, the PGA of America chief executive, said. "We think we made a great decision, but we'd rather be lucky than good as well. We thought it was smart. It looks brilliant now." Perhaps unsurprisingly, American broadcaster CBS are equally delighted, with veteran presenter Jim Nantz adding, "Who would have ever forecast that the PGA Championship would walk into year one of this, coming on the heels of one of the greatest moments in the history of the sport? The PGA Championship has hit the lottery." Previously, fourth in the calendar and in importance, the US PGA will not need to rely on slogans such as "Glory's Last Shot" or "This is Major" to drum up interest, for this year at least. Woods took care of that with his 15th major title and a first since 2008 at Augusta National last month, and is among the favourites for victory at a venue where he led from start to finish to win the 2002 US Open and was the only player to finish under par. The 43-year-old was also sixth when the tournament returned in 2009 and leads the PGA Tour in greens in regulation this season. But whether he will continue to be after a week battling thick, wet, rough on the fearsome black course at Bethpage State Park remains to be seen. Away from Wood's pursuit of Jack Nicklaus, record of 18 major titles, there is the small matter of Jordan Spieth attempting to complete the career Grand Slam and Brooks Koepka looking to defend his title as he did in last year's US Open. Spieth was second in the world after completing a third leg of the slam in the 2017 Open Championship, but has failed to win since and starts the week ranked 39th after failing to post a single top 20 finish on the PGA Tour this season. In contrast, Koepka comes into the week on the back of a tie for second behind Woods at the Masters and finishing fourth in last week's AT&T. Byron Nelson in Dallas, while his form in majors since the 2016 US PGA reads an impressive 4-11-1-6-13-1-39-1-2. The three major time winner has set himself the target of winning at least 10 and believes sometimes the majors are the easiest ones to win. There are 156 players in the field, so you figure at least 80 of them I'm going to beat, Koepka added. You figure about half of them won't play well from there, so you're just down to about maybe 35. And then from 35, pressure's on to get to them. It only leaves you with a few more, and you've just got to beat those guys. Rory McIlroy will be hoping to be among those guys after being unable to complete his own career Grand Slam at Augusta, with the Northern Irishman's tie for 21st being his worst result in the Masters since 2013. McIlroy was 20 years old and playing just his third major in the 2009 US Open at Bethpage, finishing tied for 10th after closing 68, a score beaten only by Ian Poulter's 67. His performances on the same course in the Barclays in 2012 and 2016 were nothing special, and the four-time major winner knows his long game will need to be better than it was at Augusta, where he ranked 58th for driving accuracy. Woods ranked only slightly higher at the 47th, but accuracy was never his strongest suit, and none of the sell-out crowd at Bethpage will care about such statistics if the 101st US PGA ends with Woods celebrating more improbable major glory. For lovers of coincidence, the only time Woods has won the first two majors of the season was in 2002, when he followed victory at Augusta with the US Open title at Bethpage. Different tournament, same result? This article is unattributed.
The Herald Scotland. Opinion. Recorded on the 16th of May, 2019. Letters. Close Glasgow Airport, not Prestwick. From the Letters column. Robin Johnston, a letter on May the 14th, suggests that it is time to close Prestwick Airport. I would beg to differ. Prestwick has direct access from a rail line. Would it not be better to develop Prestwick and close Glasgow Airport? This would avoid the problem of trying to have pod/light rail. From Paisley Gilmore Street and also ease congestion on the M8. Prestwick also has the advantage of being fog free and has less noise pollution to residential property, as landing and takeoff would be over open countryside or water. From the Letters column.
That's the end of part one. After the break, we'll be coming back with more great articles from the Herald Scotland. Visually impaired people are being invited to see if they are eligible for a free, specially adapted radio from a charity. The British Wireless for the Blind Fund, BWBF, provides the equipment to those with sight loss around the UK who meet its criteria. Radio is a lifeline to those who are blind and partially sighted, providing companionship and helping them to keep in touch with what's going on in the world, as well as in the local community. BWBF offers equipment free of charge to those who have sight loss and are in receipt of a means-tested benefit. BWBF is launching its Reaching Out campaign to try and increase awareness about their equipment and help more people who are blind and partially sighted. Our regional development manager, Sophie Weldon, said, "Our radios are designed so that a person with sight loss can use them easily and independently. All equipment is delivered to the home by a volunteer who sets it all up and provides support in using it. We offer a range of equipment, digital radios, CD players, memory stick players, internet radio, and even a specially designed app. Our radios are vital to someone who cannot see. They provide news, information and entertainment, but also more importantly, companionship and a friendly service. If you or someone you know is interested in a BWBF radio, please contact Sophie Weldon at sophie@blind.org.uk. That is SOPHIE@blind.org.uk or phone 01283 790 208, that's 01283 790 208, or on 07540 724 063, that is 07540 724 063. To find out more about the British Wireless for the Blind Fund, follow us on Twitter at British Wireless, like us on Facebook, or go to blind.org.uk. Now, back to the main programme. Welcome back. The headlines in part two.
Ryan Christie out of Scotland qualifiers as he targets Celtic Euro comeback.
Devolved Scottish benefit payment inundated with applications from rest of the UK.
Only grown-ups understand the case for age discrimination.
Neil Mackay. We must face up to the fact that capitalism is killing our planet.
Years and Years TV review. Nicola Sturgeon's Glasgow constituency has Scotland's highest child poverty rate.
Holyrood does not express definitive view on Scotland's future, David Mundell insists.
Agenda. Cybersecurity should be part of our culture. Man 39 charged in connection with death of Emma Folds. The Herald Scotland, Sport, recorded on the 16th of May 2019. Ryan Christie out of Scotland qualifiers as he targets Celtic Euro comeback. By Graham McGarry. Ryan Christie will miss out on both the Scottish Cup final and Scotland's doubleheader against Cyprus and Belgium in June as he targets a return to action in time for next season. After suffering a concussion and undergoing facial surgery for the injury he picked up in the Scottish Cup semi-final against Aberdeen, the attacker has been ruled out of the remainder of this campaign. He hopes to be back up to full speed, to help Celtic's quest to reach the group stages of the Champions League. I am hoping for the qualifiers in pre-season, Christie said. I am gutted to be missing a Scotland trip again, but hopefully the first day of pre-season, I'll be back in and running as normal. The first few weeks after the surgery were pretty tough, but I think I'm over the worst of it now. I'm definitely feeling better. I'm back in the fold here, and it's nice. Hopefully the recovery will be good. I'm still not training yet. I'm not due back training until next season. The first day of pre-season is what I'm aiming for. I feel fine, but it's still a question of time with this kind of stuff, especially with a head injury. I'll look forward to next season. I'll go with my girlfriend to Greece for a relaxing time in the summer, although I haven't done anything for a month, so I need to watch I don't turn into a big fat mess. Meanwhile, Christie is hoping his former club Inverness can join fellow Highlanders Ross County in the Premiership next season. That'll be nice, he said. Inverness have a job to do on Friday night. It would be nice to have them and Ross County back in the league again. The other boys are raging at travelling away back up to Dingwall and Inverness, but I'm looking forward to it. By Graham McGarry.
The Herald, 10th of May 2019. Devolved Scottish benefit payment inundated with applications from rest of the UK. Families of low incomes have been able to apply for part of a Best of Star grant, which helps cover the cost of having a baby since December. But officials in charge of a new devolved benefit were taken aback when 10% of the applicants, more than 16,000, came from outside Scotland. Social Security Secretary Shirley Ann Somerville said it signalled that there needed to be clear eligibility around residency criteria on the application form. She said there are a very significant number of applications that we are getting in the Best Star grant that were not from people in Scotland, and we therefore had to adapt that. It came as Holyrood Social Security Committee took evidence on the delivery of the transfer benefits devolved to Scotland in 2016. Last week, Scotland's spending watchdog found there is a significant risk the Scottish Government will fail to deliver billions of pounds worth of welfare payments on time. Auditor General Caroline Gardner said the new benefits agency has only managed to deliver its first relatively easy payments by working flat out and relying on costly agency staff. But it now faces a struggle to introduce a second wave of more complex benefits, which account for 98% of the £3.5 billion due to be paid to 1.4 million claimants each year by 2021. Speaking to MSPs, Ms Somerville said officials have now ensured that applicants are asked, "Do you live in Scotland?" right at the start of a process. She said clearly we have to test eligibility, but it's perhaps not something that we thought we'd have to really point out The 10% figure was higher than anticipated. She said the sheer number of applications staff had dealt with was far higher than anyone expected. David Wallace, Chief Executive of Social Security Scotland, said there had been lots of conversations about the number of applicants from outside Scotland and how the system could be improved. He added, as a direct result of that, the application now looks different. He said people could not be stopped from applying, but the warning, as it were, is up front around about your likely chance of eligibility if you're applying from a non-Scottish postcode. He said this was now front and centre of the application process, adding, I think it does just demonstrate that we're able to take the feedback that we're getting on ground and play that directly back into the system.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know somebody who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio, where our daily podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF, you need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk, and remember, when setting up the player, ask for the Q&A review channels. Now, back to the main programme.
From the Herald Opinion, recorded on the 13th of May 2019. Andrew McKee. Only grown-ups understand the case for age discrimination. Equal pay for equal work is hardly a controversial idea, said Jeremy Corbyn the other day to What Else?, a youth conference for Labour activists in Birmingham. So why are we discriminating against young people? A reasonable question, especially if you happen to be turning 70 this month and trying to curry favour with a lot of young people who already support you. To try to answer it, however, you'd need to examine the assumptions that lie behind Mr. Corbyn's statement. For a start, there's the implausible claim that there are any things outside the world of pure mathematics or formal logic that are ever equal, and the implication of that it's desirable that they should be. Next, the notion that uncontroversial ideas are by that token correct, that ignores the fact that yesterday's controversy is today's commonplace, an idea that one would have thought might have occurred to anyone whose view of the world has been shaped by the dubious Marxist doctrine of the inevitability of progress. This is what people mean when they tell you that they're on the wrong side of history, and if the objective value or truth of opinions and beliefs were determined by the calendar. Oddly, the same people usually like to frame these relativistic judgments in the language of universal and eternal rights. The most conscientious bit, though, is the last part, the claim that we are discriminating against young people. Discriminate ought to be a neutral word that just means noting the difference between things. Nowadays, because equality is uncontroversial, discrimination is a bad thing, if not an affront to natural justice. Or at any rate, discriminating against young people is. It's apparently all right in all sorts of other spheres to discriminate against older people, excepting, naturally, Jeremy Corbyn. You'll have noted the widespread view among fanatics in both the Brexit and independence debates that the only people who voted the wrong way were old, rich and racist, and that since they'll be dead soon, if they aren't already, the truly democratic result would be the opposite of what happened in the real world, which, despite the fact that it's where history is actually happening, is presumably on the wrong side of history. Similarly, in the climate debate, the fact that Greta Thunberg is 16 and has encouraged children to play hooky from school to show how much they care about the planet is in itself evidence that she's on the right side of history. Though the spectacle of middle-aged parliamentarians queuing up to listen to Miss Thunberg, while giving every indication that they were about to burst into opening lines of Whitney Houston's Greatest Love of All, is enough to make you wonder whether there is, any longer, such a thing as being grown up. Miss Thunberg may nonetheless be right, of course, but assuming that young people are right because they're young is as silly as discounting the possibility that they're right even though they are young. As it happens, the current crop of people aged 16 to 25 look, on a good deal of the evidence, to be rather more thoughtful, diligent, sober and self-motivating than their elders, especially if you're comparing them with the 45 to 65-year-old incompetents who make up most of the political and cultural establishment. Their notions of the young are entirely inconsistent. There are constant calls to raise the age at which people can drink or smoke, to outlaw advertisements for food that includes fat, salt or sugar, i.e. almost all food, restrict internet access, or to create blanket prohibitions on all kinds of adult behaviour on the basis that such measures protect the young. Simultaneously, the same people argue that we should lower the voting age, pay teenagers the same as older workers, and abolish any distinction made on basis of age. But unlike discrimination on the basis of race, sex, class, or in other areas where it seems irrelevant and obviously wrong, the idea that we should not discriminate on the basis of age, or rather, we should do so illogically and selectively, is bizarre. It was probably the creation of the generation which is now dying out, if they're not turning their hearing aids down at the Rolling Stones concerts, which only the very old and rich can afford to attend. I think that this attitude was first identified by the novelist Colin McInnes, born in 1914, who latched on to, if he didn't quite invent, the teenager. In Absolute Beginners, 1959, he describes youth as possessing a power that adults fear, and consequently that they keep a secret from the young. "You made us minors with your parliamentary watsits," the narrator tells his mother. "Then, suddenly, you oldos found that though we minors had no rights, we had the money power." Today's teenagers and young adults can reasonably complain that the generation, the my generation, of perpetually adolescent contemporaries of Mr. Corbyn, has hung on to the money power while denying them the same opportunities. The problem with these old people, in fact, is that they're too young. But there remains a case for treating young people differently, and not merely the economic ones, that a higher minimum wage might reduce employment opportunities from that age group, or that the state has no business dictating the value of labour. We discriminate against young people because they are in some respect adults, and in others, not yet fully responsible. There are many aspects of the world in which youth has the whip hand over age. The greatest achievements in poetry, mathematics, and popular music, for example, have tended to come from the very young. There are others in which the qualities of youth, idealism, urgency, energy, an infinite sense of possibility, reluctance to compromise, impatience with restraint, refusal to distinguish between one's passions and their intrinsic value, create hazards as great as their advantages. That may be a depressing-sounding argument for age before beauty, cynicism over idealism, indifference over enthusiasm, and hoping to grow old before you die. But the old know what it's like to be young, while the young can't know what it's like to be old. In matters of age, there's a case for discrimination, which used to be a prize word synonymous with wisdom, judgment, and above all, maturity. Mr. Corbyn wouldn't understand that, but then he's not a grown-up.
Article from Herald Scotland, 14th of May 2019. Opinion. Neil Mackay. We must face up to the fact that capitalism is killing our planet. There is one thing certain in our age of uncertainty. Capitalism in its current form cannot continue. It's eating the planet. Climate change cannot be solved without tackling the inherent problems in this late-stage malignant form of capitalism that has marked the last 40 years of history. This is not a manifesto for Marxism. Human beings need to trade, sell their labour, and accumulate wealth and property. To deny that is as foolish as to deny the need for food and sex. It's part of who we are as a species. But the current form of capitalism, which holds sway over human affairs, has nothing to do with trade or entrepreneurialism, and everything to do with rampant greed and institutionalized inequality. Unbridled mass consumption and the almost suicidal glee with which industries from fashion to farming trash the planet will be our undoing. So hard choices need to be made. What matters most, the super rich or the planet? To me, there's no debate. A global 1% versus the rest. I know which side I'm on. Scotland is already seeing which way the wind is blowing and having to act accordingly. The SNP government has backtracked on its manifesto pledge to cut airline taxes and was hammered by business leaders for hypocrisy. Here's an example of the difficult choices that governments around the world will have to start making. Do we put economic growth above the safety of the planet? This is the taste of the terrible medicine we must drink. What's the point of enabling lots of tourists to fly cheaply to Scotland if the planet has tipped over into crisis point within a generation? Of course, seen from the old-fashioned perspective of early 20th century capitalism, the U-turn is deeply humiliating for the SNP. It's another case of politicians lying, business says. To my eyes, it's nothing of the sort. It was messily handled, but it was a hard decision that needed to be taken. After Nicola Sturgeon declared a climate emergency, what other decision could have been made? The UN's Intergovernmental Report on Biodiversity and Ecosystems, which was released last week, painted a devastating picture of the impact of humans on nature. 1 million animal and plant species face extinction. World population has doubled since 1970. To feed, heat and clothe us, forests have been obliterated. 100 million hectares of tropical forest went in just 20 years. Only 13% of wetlands remain. Urban living has doubled. The world has become a rubbish tip. The report is screaming in our faces that we're killing the planet, ourselves and our children. Another report has warned that entire communities in the UK might need to move away from coasts and rivers as temperatures rise. The UK's Committee on Climate Change logically suggests that global warming will inevitably restrict the growth of aviation in Britain. The cold truth is that instead of paying less to fly, we need to pay more. Not a lot extra, but certainly to cut taxes on carbon-emitting industries is tantamount to cutting our own throats. On a return flight from Glasgow to Barcelona, a single passenger is responsible for 0.37 tonnes of CO2. A mere £2.81 on the ticket price will offset those emissions. Is that going to kill us? No. Would cutting air tax kill us? Maybe. One day. Soon. This difficult conversation is starting to happen at the right level, as we see with the SNP's air tax dilemma, and Labour contemplating delisting companies from the stock exchange which fail to tackle climate change. But there's a reluctance within society to take the necessary radical steps. Since when was survival radical? The fear seems to lie in the belief that perhaps someday we might be rich too, and we don't want to have to be taxed hard when that fantasy day dawns. Forget it. Your chances of doing anything other than financially struggling throughout your life are all but guaranteed. Unless you're born wealthy, born a genius, born beautiful, born to kick a ball, or born to perform, your chances of becoming rich, and I mean really rich, not just owning a nice house and car that might one day be taken off you by the bank because you lost your job, are basically nil, though you might win the lottery. The trajectory of the global economy over the last 40 years is as depressing as the climate. In his book Capital in the 21st Century, economist Thomas Piketty shows how since the 1970s, the return on capital has been greater than the rate of economic growth. In other words, to quote the old 1920s song, "One thing's sure and nothing surer, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer." Equality was ameliorated to some degree in the wake of two world wars and the Great Depression with initiatives like the New Deal in America and the welfare state in Britain. Ideas at the time which were seen as wildly radical, primarily by mouthpieces of the rich. There's no question that we need a new Green Deal to tackle the climate crisis that late-stage capitalism has created, a game-changing set of policies, penalties and incentives to rebalance the economy. Carbon emissions need zeroed out at breakneck speed. Green industries must replace dirty industries. The super-rich need to be subjected to wealth taxes, and human beings, each of us, need to face the fact that TVs aren't meant to go on a scrap heap after 5 years, that two long-haul holidays a year might keep us happy, but we're killing the world for our entertainment. Change won't impoverish the likes of you or I, but if we're smart, it will curb the Romanov-style greed of the super-rich and recalibrate an economy which will make our lives better and even, maybe, our pockets fuller. The future is green. Already, China is dominating the international market for solar panels and electric vehicles. These technologies point the way towards new jobs. Capitalism can be tamed. It doesn't need to tame us. Green economics offer hope and fairness. We have to make the changes. Otherwise, we're just idiot bystanders on a burning planet, getting our pockets picked by the people who set the world alight in the first place.
Remember, this Weekly Digest programme is just a selection of what we produce. You can access more daily content online for free at qnreview.com/free podcasts for free daily podcasts of the Herald Scotland and Evening Times and weekly digests of The National and Inside Soap magazine. Alternatively, you can access all of these services via a BWBF Sonata Plus internet radio player. Now, back to the main programme.
The
The Glasgow Herald, Thursday 16th of May 2019. Arts and Entertainment, from 15th May. Years and Years TV Review by Alison Rowett, Senior Politics and Features Writer. I have seen the future and it sucks. On the downside, according to the new drama from Russell T. Davis that started last night, the world is a more dangerous, fretful place and man's inhumanity to man still makes countless thousands mourn. On the upside, MacBook Airs still work. Phew, right? Starting in the present day, Years and Years takes the Lyons family from Manchester through the next decade and a half. One minute a baby is born, and in the next scene we see him having a first birthday party, and so on. Come the end of the first six episodes, it's 2024, and the extended clan, four siblings, their partners, children and grandmother, have gathered for a celebration dinner. One way or another, it is set to be a night none of them will forget. Running alongside the family saga is the rise of entrepreneur-turned-populist politician Vivian Rook, Emma Thompson, a shark-beaked, razor-elbowed operator who wants the bins emptied once a week and doesn't give a flying fig, I paraphrase, about politics in the Middle East. Her four-letter appearance on Question Time Type is the stuff of Fiona Bruce's nightmares. Not that Bruce makes an appearance. This time, the BBC cameo, I'm beginning to wonder if it is mandatory, goes to newsreader Rita Chakrabarti, playing newsreader. Very convincing she is too. Meanwhile, lurking in the background to all of this is a dispute between Trump's America and China over an island stuffed with nuclear weapons. Did anyone order another Cuban missile crisis? Davies is more concerned with the future than the past. The creator of Queer as Folk and the regenerator of Doctor who has a knack for accurately gauging the mood of the times. In Years and Years, the marker falls somewhere between exasperated and scunnered, it's a Scottish gauge, as when the council officer, Daniel Lyons, Russell Tovey, says, I don't know if I could have a kid in a world like this. Things were okay a few years ago, before 2008. Do you remember? We used to think politics was boring, but now I worry about everything. I don't know what to worry about first. Never mind the government, it's the sodding banks. They terrify me. It's not even them. It's the companies, the brands, the corporations. They treat us like algorithms while they go around poisoning the air. And on he goes. And on. He likes a speech, does Mr. Davis. And the tone of some of them can be a little grumpy old men. Isn't everything rubbish these days? At times. The characters, with the exception of Rook, will she turn out to be Nigel Farage in a skirt suit, are so far fairly predictable. The single mum, etc. But just take a look at the cast. Tovey, Thompson, Rory Kinnear, Jessica Hines, Anne Reid, Last Tango in Halifax. Any one of them could headline a series on their own, yet they all turn out for Davis. Depending on whether or not you agree with his politics, Davis is either the switched-on voice of modern society or a right-on preacher. Years and Years is certainly a political piece, but so far the P is small and the odd lengthy speech apart fairly soft. There is anger here, but there is also warmth and laughter and characters to care about. While Years and Years might be about the way we live now and in the near future, its core concern is the family and the need to look out for and be kind to each other. Be it 5 or 55 years from now, that's a message worth hearing. This article by Alison Rowett, Senior Politics and Features Writer for the Glasgow Herald.
This article from the Herald on Wednesday the 15th of May, 2019 news. Nicola Sturgeon's Glasgow constituency has Scotland's highest child poverty rate. Ministers must take urgent action to deal with the staggering levels of child poverty that parts of Scotland are facing, campaigners have demanded. In 8 of Scotland's 32 local authorities, more than a quarter of all children are growing up in poverty, new figures showed. In the Glasgow City Council area, almost two-fifths, 37% of youngsters are living in families that are struggling to get by, according to the End Child Poverty Coalition. In the Glasgow Southside constituency, where First Minister Nicola Sturgeon is the MSP, the data showed that 46% of children are in families that are in poverty after housing costs have been taken away into account.
Her constituency had the greatest proportion of youngsters in poverty in Scotland, ahead of Glasgow Shettleston, 42%, and Glasgow Kelvin, 41%. That compares to a child poverty rate of 11% in the nearby Eastwood constituency, with the same level also recorded in the Shetland Islands. The figures were calculated by researchers at the University of Loughborough for the End Child Poverty, a coalition of more than 70 organisations including children's charities, faith groups, trade unions and others. While the Scottish Government has pledged to introduce a new family income supplement to help those in need, campaigners said the action was needed before the planned timescale for this of 2022. John Dickey, Director of Child Poverty Action Group in Scotland, said, "Today's stark figures outline the staggering levels of child poverty that many of our communities face. There is no question rising child poverty is driven by UK government, social security cuts, but Scottish ministers must act now for the utmost urgency to introduce the promised income supplement." Mr. Dickey, also a member of the End Child Poverty in Scotland umbrella group, added, "These aren't just statistics. These are children going hungry, missing out on school trips, unable to enjoy the activities and opportunities their better off peers take for granted." Jackie Brock, the Chief Executive of Children in Scotland, said, "The 500,000 increase in children poverty across the UK since 2010 was a shameful indictment of a social security system which has failed children and failed families." She added, "The Scottish Government's commitment to introduce a new family income supplement is welcome, but today's figures show that too many families cannot afford to wait until 2022 to see this support. Early implementation is essential." Ms. Brock also demanded the UK Government lift its two-child cap on allowances for tax credits and universal credits and end the benefits freeze, which means welfare payments have failed to keep pace with inflation. Marion Davis, Head of Policy at One Parent Family Scotland, said, "An increasing number of children in single-parent families live in poverty. Because of the combined impact of the benefits freeze, universal credit, a two-child limit on social security payments and the benefits cap. It is an urgent priority for the UK Government to reverse these cuts and for Scottish Government to implement policies such as income supplement to help tackle inequality to make Scotland a fairer, more equal country." A Scottish Government spokesman said, "Scotland is the only part of the UK to set statutory targets for reducing child poverty and our plan outlines the range of actions we are taking in areas such as employment, social security and education to lift low-income households out of poverty. We are doing this in the face of continued UK government welfare cuts, which will see 3.7 billion reductions in annual spend on social security for Scotland in 2020-2021. We have invested over £125 million to mitigate the worst impacts of these cuts, funding we'd rather spend on anti-poverty measures. We are committed to the introduction of the income supplement within the lifetime of the Child Poverty Plan."
Holyrood does not express definitive view on Scotland's future, David Mundell insists. An article by Michael Settle, UK political editor, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 14th of May 2019. Holyrood does not express Scotland's definitive view on constitutional matters, David Mundell insists, as he argues Scottish voters want a future of devolution, not independence. In an exclusive interview with the Herald to mark the 20th anniversary of the creation of the new Scottish Parliament, the Scottish Secretary is adamant that refusing to concede to Nicola Sturgeon's call for a second vote on the nation's future is fully in line with the devolved settlement. When it is suggested that refusing the First Minister's demand mandated by MSPs in March 2017 for so-called Indyref 2, is not respecting Britain's system of devolution, Mr Mundell disagrees and declares, yes it is, because the responsibility for constitutional matters, such as holding a referendum, rests with the UK government as part of the devolution settlement. And therefore, while the Scottish Parliament has the right to ask for a referendum, and I fully respect that right, we have the right to say no. When it is also put to him that Holyrood believes it represents the will of the Scottish people, but he does not, the Secretary of State replies, no, Scotland has two parliaments, it has two governments. The basis for a referendum was well documented in 2014. Asked if it is therefore up to the UK Parliament to decide the limits of devolution, Mr Mundell tells the Herald, I don't recognise the way in which you are construing that, because devolution means that certain matters are the responsibility of the Scottish Parliament, so, like education and health, these are almost a full responsibility. I put through orders in this Parliament to ensure that policies I don't agree with in Scotland are in force. Free prescriptions. I didn't agree with that policy at that time. I have put through the orders in this Parliament in relation to devolved matters, even though I don't agree with them, because I accept the Scottish Parliament has responsibility. On the Constitution, it is a matter that is reserved to the Westminster Parliament. The Scottish Parliament is entitled to express an opinion and a view in relation to other matters, but it is not the definitive view of Scotland. The Cabinet Minister explains how the nature of devolution means it has limits. I have never suggested devolution is independence. It's not. The judgment the people of Scotland made was, yes, devolution of the issues and subsequent issues is the way forward because we have benefited from having two parliaments and from the best of both worlds, as it is sometimes construed. Tony Blair. Scotland is right to stay in the EU, but it would be wrong to leave the UK. Mr Mundell expresses concern about how voters, and indeed politicians, conflate the Scottish Parliament with the Scottish Government. The public mindset, he believes, needs to change. Most people who have negativities towards the Scottish Parliament, what they mean is they don't like the Scottish Government. Whereas here at Westminster, despite all its flaws, people don't think John Bercow is running the country. They understand the House of Commons is different from Theresa May and her government. We haven't sufficiently been able to differentiate the Scottish Parliament as an institution from the Scottish government. Noting how no one is to blame for this situation, he says, my dear friend Michael Russell, I have had to pull him up many times in discussions he has had here where he says the Scottish Parliament and this and the Scottish Parliament that, and he means the Scottish Government. They can conflate the two. The Parliament is different from the Government, and for us the institution develops, grows, matures. All of these additional powers and responsibilities it is taking on or will eventually take on when the Scottish Government can get round to dealing with them, we need to see that the differentiation so people think the Parliament is different from the people who are running the Government. The Scottish Secretary admits that the Conservatives, who vehemently opposed devolution before the 1997 referendum, fearing a yes vote could break up the union, should have been quicker to accept the new settlement, which was voted for by nearly 75% of Scotland on a 60% turnout. He claims the Tories made a perfectly legitimate case in opposing devolution, but once it had become clear it was the settled will of the Scottish people that it was going to happen, it would have been better to have accepted that earlier. Sir John Curtis. Devolution was supposed to kill nationalism stone dead. It's very much alive. Mr. Mundell, who has held his cabinet post since 2015, goes on, I always pay tribute to David McClatchy, the late Scottish Conservative leader, because what he did was, as a leader, he took us into that parliament and acted in a combative but a constructive way. And the 18 Tory MSPs who were elected in 1999 and all their successors have always embraced and worked for the Parliament and for devolution. Once the referendum decision had been made, they completely put behind their previous position. The 56-year-old MP for or Dumfriesshire, Clydesdale and Tweeddale makes clear Holyrood has now established itself as part of Scottish life, but its potential has been unfulfilled, not because of the Parliament itself, but because of the governments since 1999. The initial Labour-Liberal governments were dull. They didn't take any risks, really, in terms of what they did. The smoking ban was probably the biggest challenge to orthodoxy that took place, and I commend the Parliament for that decision. Since 2007, when the SNP took power, the constitution has ultimately dominated, he complains, claiming the Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon administrations have held back the development of Scottish devolution. Education is the biggest indictment, declares Mr. Mundell. If 20 years ago, as we took our oath, people would have said after 20 years of this Parliament, there would be more young people leaving school without any qualifications at all, people would have been stunned. They believed, as I did, that this Parliament was about enhancing and taking forward Scottish education and its traditions and its differences and making it even better, and that has not happened. I put a large part of that down to 10 years when the Scottish Parliament has been focusing entirely on and such a big part of its emotional effort on the Constitution. It's unfulfilled. When it is pointed out how the Tories bang on about the possibility of Scottish independence because the Constitution is just as good electorally and politically for them as it is for the SNP, Mundell says, I can make a commitment right now that if Nicola Sturgeon takes independence and another referendum off the table, I'll stop speaking about it. I can give that absolute commitment. 2 weeks ago, the First Minister set out how there has to be another referendum. She wants to have a bill and citizens' assemblies. I don't want to have any of those things. But the Herald points out Miss Sturgeon and her colleagues would never take independence off the table, and he knows it, given the SNP's raison d'etre is to campaign for an independent Scotland. He adds, the SNP's route to independence used to be they would deliver good government. People will think we have done such a good job, we should be given the whole responsibility. That has been abandoned because their record on domestic issues has been so poor.
Q and Review Print Speaking to the Blind are a charity based in Bishop Briggs. We're currently looking to recruit volunteer access to audio ambassadors in East and Bartonshire to place leaflets and business cards at businesses, shops and amenities in the area, and to show the public how to listen to daily and weekly online articles from the Herald Scotland, Evening Times, The National and Inside Soap magazine for free. If you would like to volunteer and become an access to audio ambassador, please contact Michael Rankin on 0141 772 3976 or email aaatl@qandreview.com. That's aaatl@qandreview.com. In addition, we are also recruiting for volunteer readers and technicians. If you're interested in reading or technically supporting a recording team, please contact us on 0141 772 3976 or email information@qandreview.com. Details of all of our volunteering opportunities are available on our website at qandreview.com. Thank you. Now, back to the main programme.
The Herald Scotland. Opinion. Recorded on the 10th of May, 2019. Agenda. Cybersecurity should be part of our culture. From the Agenda column by Ross Foley, Cybersecurity Director, PwC Scotland. Cybersecurity has become one of the major societal challenges of the internet age. What was once the domain of IT and security professionals has become a board-level business issue, a challenge which each of us face on a daily basis. The paradigm shift we have experienced in terms of the threat must be mirrored in the scale of our response. We must give all people the skills to protect themselves and ultimately ensure the cyber resilience of UK PLC. I was infused by the message of collaboration and teamwork that came across loud and clear from key figures from both the public and private sectors at the recent Cyber UK event in Glasgow. In his opening address to delegates, Kieran Martin, CEO of NCSC, the government agency responsible for cybersecurity, described the event as the coming together of the team tasked with defending the UK in cyberspace. Working as a team, there are three equally important challenges we must address in order if we are to achieve the Scottish Government's aim of becoming a world leader in cyber resilience, and create an environment where cybersecurity simply becomes embedded in our culture, both at home and in the workplace. 1. Provide all citizens with a baseline knowledge of the tools and techniques they can use to protect themselves in cyberspace. 2. Create a sustainable and broad pipeline of cybersecurity talent. 3. Foster a culture of collaboration between government, our security services and the private sector. An effective first step is to recognise that cybersecurity is now simply a fundamental life skill for children of the internet age, one which goes hand in hand with the road and personal safety lessons that we all remember from our own school days. For businesses, cybersecurity must become as fundamental as health and safety has now become, and at a public sector level, it must sit among others deemed critical to a functioning society, such as healthcare or the emergency services. It's also important to recognise that the next generation of cyber defenders are not just security managers or coders, but everyone from the future CEOs to any worker who views, holds or processes information. Technology, data and electronic communications are so intrinsically linked with our lives that cybersecurity begins and ends with every employee of an organisation or every citizen of a state. Ultimately, the more we build security into the culture of our citizens, the more cyber resilient our organisations will be. The work of organisations such as Skill Development Scotland are fundamental to addressing these challenges, driving a sustainable pipeline of cybersecurity professionals. However, while we have a steady stream of technical graduates from highly respected cybersecurity degree programmes at both Abertay and Napier universities, it is imperative that we remember that security requires a broad range of technical and non-technical disciplines. The cybersecurity industry has also long been criticised for its lack of diversity, with NCSC commenting in 2017 that we needed a much more diverse workforce in order to combat ever more sophisticated cyber threats. Driving greater diversity of gender, ethnicity, background and thought are all vital aspects of creating a cyber resilient workforce. While the challenge may seem daunting, it is clear that the appetite to drive change is real. All cybersecurity professionals hold a duty to facilitate this agenda, so I look forward to further opportunities for our community to come together and support the cross-sector conversation and collaboration required to build the foundations of our future cyber resilience. From the Agenda column by Ross Foley, Cybersecurity Director, PwC Scotland. The Herald Scotland News, recorded on the 10th of May, 2019. Man, 39, charged in connection with death of Emma Faulds. From the Herald Scotland Online. A 39-year-old man has been arrested and charged in connection with the death of Ayrshire woman Emma Faulds. Ms. Faulds from Kilmarnock was last seen in the Moncton area at around 9:10 p.m. on Sunday, April the 28th. Police said the man was due to appear in Ayrshire Court on Friday. From the Herald Scotland Online.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland. This weekly Talking Newspaper Digest was a Q&Review recording service production. The readers were volunteers at Q&Review, and the producer was Jordan Duncan. Q&Review Recording Service Limited is a registered Scottish charity, number SC018016. Our registered office is at 18 Crowhill Road, Bishop Briggs, Glasgow, G641QY. Remember, you can always get in contact with us by email at information@qandreview.com or by leaving us a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976.